Okay, well, thanks. First I have to explain to you what microlensing is, how it works, which is very, very simple. If you have an observer and they're looking at some distant star, say in the center of our galaxy, so 10 kiloparsecs away, then if there's an object in between the observer and the source that has some gravity, so for example, a star, but anyway, anything with gravity, then it'll bend the light from the source, according to Einstein's equations, to the observer. There's two paths here it could take. And if you could actually have an excellent telescope, you could see both of the images. In fact, these images are separated by typically less than a milliarcsecond, so you can't see the separate images. But because this is a convex system, the combined area of the images is bigger than the area of the source, and the surface brightness is conserved. So the combined light from the images is brighter than the source. So this wouldn't help you very much by itself because you don't know how bright the source is supposed to be. But fortunately, typically the lens moves in front of or and then away from the source on timescales of a few weeks. And so the brightness is a monotonic function of the projected separation, and so therefore you get one of these things, microlensing event. So these microlensing events were first described, not events, but anyway, microlensing was first described by Einstein in 1912 before he developed general relativity. He dismissed this as being unobservable based on some simple calculations he did. He didn't actually even write up the idea until 1936 when he was harassed by a Czech engineer who came from Prague to Princeton to personally bug him until he wrote up the idea. And then he still dismissed it in print. So microlensing only really got started. The reason he dismissed it is because these things are too rare. In the 1930s, the number you could calculate, although Einstein didn't calculate this, but he gave up before he got to the end of the calculation, you calculate that if you continuously looked at all the stars in the sky that were known at that time, it would take 100 years before you saw a microlensing event. So this field revived when Bode-Puchinsky realized with modern equipment and looking at the right fields that you could see many microlensing events, and so it's got its start. And shortly after that, after he suggested this idea, a few years after, and then working with student Xu Dumao, they considered the idea that instead of just considering one mass, that you would have two masses. You might think if you get a bump from one mass, you get two bumps from two masses. But actually, the second mass causes an astigmatism in the lensing system and gives rise to these caustics, which are formally lines of infinite magnification when a point source crosses it. So there aren't any point sources, all sources are extended. And so if you have the source going across one of these caustic structures caused by a binary lens, then you would get maybe some bumps, maybe some other structures. And they particularly considered the idea that if this binary lens was not two equal masses, but two masses differing by a factor of 1,000 or so, like a star-planet system, you would still get a caustic, although much smaller. So in this case, we're looking over here, it could be if you pass very far away that there's no effect at all. But if you pass over it, you could have some bumps and detect the planet this way. So this was the kind of birth of planet searches by microlensing. So the next year, Avi Loeb and I considered a more generic case of the same phenomenon. And in this case, the structure that's caused is more separated. Well, I'll show you a picture of it later, but anyway, if the planet is in a more generic position relative to the source and lens, you get a big bump for the main star and a little bump for the planet. These two bumps don't each look like the original bumps. They're somewhat distorted, but anyway, basically you get two bumps. And the bumps, timescale of these bumps scales as the square root of the mass. So if you see a big bump and a little bump shorter by a factor of 30, it means the mass ratio is 1,000, and that's Jupiter and the Sun. So you can tell if you have two bumps, they're described by six parameters, right? So you got a height, a width, and a central time for each bump. And then this translates into six parameters that you can use to describe the microlensing event. Actually, these parameters are not describing, the three parameters here are basically describing the big bump, and then the other three parameters are describing the angle at which the source is passing relative to the system defined by the planet-star separation. So there's the size of the separation and then the mass ratio. And what Avi and I said at that time was you could just read off these six parameters by just looking at the light curve, which turns out to be basically true. So here we see, this is a case which I actually did try to read off these things, but you know, I won't go through the exercise with you, but here's a big bump. There's a little dip. Now, I didn't talk to you about dips yet, but anyway, there can be dips as well as bumps. And so just by, you know, by eye examination of this with some knowledge, you can figure out what the mass ratio and so forth is. But there's actually another parameter that comes into this, which is the width of the caustic crossing. Now, why does this come in? Originally, when Avi and I were thinking about this, we were thinking in a very abstract way. But the if the source has a finite size, and the way you're detecting this is by the source passing over a caustic generated by the whole structure, the astigmatism, then the time it takes the source to cross the caustic is another parameter that you can measure. And so that brings you up to seven effects, seven parameters, and seven structures. And you can actually see that in this case. In this case, there's a, you know, there's this overall dip. When you look at it closely, it takes a while for the dip to take place. And that's because it takes a while for the source to cross over this caustic. So again, you can just read this off. And for this particular event, I went through the exercise of figuring it out without looking at what the final answer was. It's figured out by computers. And I was right in all the parameters to within 1 or 2%. So it's a very simple system to basically understand. Okay, this is the situation of planets. We, you know, the main use of microlensing today is to find planets. This is the situation of planets 4 years ago when the Kepler satellite first announced all of its planets, or anyway, its candidates, which is shown here. So previously, people have been finding planets by a radial velocity method. This has a bias against more distant planets because radial velocities are smaller. So you have to find more massive planets around the stars at large separation. The transit method before Kepler was finding these very close-in planets only and pretty big. And then Kepler started finding these. Now it's found like, you know, five times as many as over here, but the situation is basically the same. They're dribbling out here. And then microlensing is finding these planets out here. So the microlensing planets are well separated from all the other planets, and they're telling us about the planets beyond the snow line. So the snow line is supposed to be where the massive planets are forming. It's supposed to be the real nursery of planets. And the other methods are not really probing this, except for the most massive planets. So that's the niche of microlensing. On the other hand, you've got a zillion planets here from Kepler, and we have in this diagram maybe 11 planets or something by now. There's 30 planets that are published. Maybe another 20 in the pipeline, but that's going to increase very rapidly, as I'll show you. Okay, so this is just a different view of excuse me, how we detect planets. You got the source going by the lens. It's imaged into two images. One of these is traveling around the Einstein ring, which is a characteristic scale of this phenomenon. The other one's traveling around inside the Einstein ring. If the image passes a planet, then the planet's gravity further distorts the image, and you get a blip. If you have a planet at the same separation, but not in the way of an image, pretty much nothing happens. So you only detect planets statistically. You don't detect planets in every system that you look at. Okay, so Avi and I put forward this idea in 1992 for how to search for these things. And then it took until 2003. Well, first of all, it took a few years for anybody to start looking. So in 1995, people started trying to find these things this way. Then to kill 2003 in order to find the first planet. This is the first planet. It looks more or less like what Avi said it would look like. You see there's a big bump for the star, little bump for the planet. We give it as our exercise to our grad students to try to figure out what the mass ratio is, which you can do in about, you know, 20 minutes if you know what you're doing. And you know, the mass ratio here is about 10 to the minus 4. So the same thing as more or less Sun and Neptune. And so this is the first cold Neptune that was ever discovered, even though it was only the third microlensing planet. So this is another, this is an event which is relatively high magnification. It has this complicated structure at the peak, which is very similar to what Avi and very similar to what Mao and Kaczynski were positing, and so many planets are found like this. But that's those are going to diminish in the future. The ones, the more typical ones, are going to be the ones more commonly found. Okay, so microlensing. As soon as you realize the microlensing, you find planets, you're getting excited, and then immediately you have to get depressed, because these parameters that you found, of all these parameters, basically only one is really a fundamental interest. That's the mass ratio. Any other system where you find planets and you found the mass ratio, already you found the mass of the planet because you're looking at the star. So, okay, you may not know its mass exactly, but 10%, you take a spectrum of it or something. But in microlensing, you can't see the star you're looking at. You're looking at some other star. And in fact, that glare from that star is preventing you even from seeing the star that's the host of the planet. So you have to figure out some way to get the mass and distance of this host, and therefore of the planet. So fairly early on, I realized that, in fact, even the first paper I wrote on this, that there are two parameters you could measure in principle, and if you could measure both parameters from the microlensing event, then you could get the mass and distance. So this is sort of a holy grail, which I'll show you is very difficult to reach. Okay, so it's a very simple thing here, just taking the same diagram, reverse it, the observer's here, the source is here. You have the light's being bent by the lens over here. Here's the Einstein radius, which I'll claim to you is an in principle measurable parameter, the angular Einstein radius. And this right here is called the projected Einstein radius. So if I was over here, I'd be at the edge of the Einstein ring, and I'd see a magnification of 1.3. Over here, I'd see something hugely magnified. If I had a satellite over here, I'd know how far away the satellite was, and I'd realize that this is the projected size of the Einstein ring. So both these things are in principle measurable. If I measured them both, I could just take this, the ratio, so small angle approximation, this angle to this distance is the same as this angle to this distance. I've written that up here. Then I've just cross-multiplied, and I notice that one of the terms in this, this angle, is the Einstein bending angle, which is given by this formula here. And so therefore, I multiply these through, and I see that the product of these two measurable quantities is equal to the mass in terms of two physical constants. And the ratio is telling you the source lens relative parallax. So you would get the mass and distance if you could measure those two things. So I was very happy to discover this at the very beginning. And then I immediately became depressed. Okay, and not immediately, but took a couple of years. So how are you going to measure these things? I told you, if you could resolve the system, then you could actually see the two images separated. You know how far apart they were, and you know the Einstein radius, but you can't do it. So what's the way that you can do it? Well, if the source passes directly over the lens, then you get this sort of flat top curve over here. And so the size of this flat topping compared to the Einstein radius tells you the size of the source compared to the angular Einstein radius. But you know the size of the source because you can measure its color and magnitude relative to some standards. And then, you know, just from the surface brightness, you can figure out the angular size of the source, and therefore you know the angular size of the Einstein ring. So that's great, it's very enlightening and so forth, but it's very depressing as well because the source is typically a microarc second, the Einstein ring is a milliarc second. It means that this happens 1 in 1,000 events. At the time I figured this out, there were no events, but anyway, subsequently, there were a few events, but now there's like, so far there have been 20,000 events discovered, so this method is going to apply to 20 of those events. Okay, so we're back at this thing, looking at the other element, this. Okay, so if you're going to put a satellite here, that's great, but people didn't have satellites, but another way to do it is to wait for the Earth to move around the Sun. And so this is the most complicated diagram I'm going to show you, which explains about microlens parallax. Okay, right here, forget about microlensing. We just have two stars. The blue star is closer and the red star is further away. They're moving this way, that's called their proper motion, and then they're moving back and forth on the sky due to parallax, and the one that's further away is moving away less. So back before, Gaia and Parcos, people used to consider relative parallaxes. They used to be measuring the parallax of one star relative to another one. They couldn't figure out absolutely how it's measured. So that's what I'm doing over here. I put the red star always at the same place, and I put the blue star moving back and forth relative to it. no microlensing yet, but now I've considered that these are the source and the lens in a microlensing event, and I've drawn the Einstein ring around it. And now you can see the impact. When two things are getting closer together, there's a bump, giant bump, and when they're further apart, then there's a dip. You get all these bumps here. I've also shown you in green what microlensing event you would see from the sun. The microlensing event that you see from the sun actually looks like a normal microlensing event, whereas the one that you see from the Earth does not look like a normal microlensing event. Well, you haven't looked at that many microlensing events, but it doesn't look normal. This is a normal microlensing event. So what's wrong here? This diagram contains all the physics, but it's actually been tweaked so that you can't really understand the normal events. And that's because you notice this thing is going back and forth. Every one of these back and forth is a year. So this event takes many years inside the Einstein ring, whereas typical events take 20 or 30 days. Okay? So that's the situation over here. Now the source, you know, in the 20 days or so, from the sun you see this, from the Earth you see this. They both look like normal microlensing events. I mean, they're offset in time and so forth, but I mean, they basically both look normal. So if you had an observatory on the sun and also on the Earth, by looking at these two things simultaneously, you could figure out what the parallax was. But if you just look at one of them, you just see a normal microlensing event. It's not like this, where all these wiggles take place. The last thing I want to say about this diagram is that whereas trigonometric parallax is a scalar, microlensing parallax is a vector. And the reason for that is, in trigonometric parallax, you see both stars. So you don't have to worry about what the orientation is. You don't have to solve for it because you just look at it in the sky. You know its orientation relative to the parallactic motion of the Earth. But in the case of microlensing, you don't see them, and therefore you have to solve for them simultaneously. And this turns out to be pretty important. Okay, so here was my prediction in 1992 of what parallax would look like. I made this prediction for a four-year event, even though there was no events discovered at all then, but no events were thought to last this long. But I just showed it as a matter of principle. Within a couple of years, people actually discovered this effect. You know, not many wiggles, but anyway, one wiggle during a year. And here's an actual case where there are several wiggles that's been discovered. So when you actually go through this and ask, okay, so most events do not look like this because they're not long enough to have this distortion. When you go through and ask how often that you actually see this level of distortion, it's maybe, where you can really measure this, it's maybe 1 in 100 times. So probably you can do the math. If you multiply 100 by 1,000, you get 100,000. It means that 1 in 100,000 events is going to satisfy both of these criteria and get, you know, you're going to be able to get the mass and distance to the light. And so I got very depressed about this. But other people didn't even get depressed. They just considered this is sort of just something that idiots are going to work on, that nobody else is going to be concerned with. And so nobody except me worked on this for, I don't know, 20 years, pretty close to 20 years. Now, I should say that whereas these full parallaxes are rare, it's actually quite common to get one-dimensional parallaxes. Remember, microlensing parallax is a vector. And so, although it's quite common to get them, it's not quite common to publish them because they're useless. Because what we're trying to figure out is the amplitude of this parallax, and so it takes on all manner of values. It's consistent with zero, it's also consistent with this thing out here. And so you have pretty much no information. The reason that they're published at all, in this case, this is published because it was the first time people realized about one-dimensional parallaxes. And then in other cases, there's a few cases where it's actually, here's another one of these, here's one where it's actually useful because it's so far separated from zero, which is over here, at least at the two sigma level, that you can maybe conclude something. Here's one where you can conclude something definitively. Anyway, there's a handful of cases where it's useful, but usually it's not used. So it's a very desperate situation. Here's the basic reason why one-dimensional parallaxes occur. Microlensing events are symmetric. So if the lens source motion is along the direction of the Earth's acceleration, then the event's going to rise faster than it's going to fall. And then you're trying to fit a square peg in a round hole because you're trying to submit something that's asymmetric into a symmetric form, and you get these residuals, it's very clear. But if you have it going the opposite direction, you still have distortions, but these distortions are degenerate with other symmetric parameters in the problem, and you get pretty much nothing. So this is what makes this a tough game. Okay, so what can be done about it? One thing is you could just focus on nearby low-mass lenses. Why nearby and low-mass? Well, the microlensing parallax parameter pi e, or square root of it is, square of it is equal to the relative parallax divided by the mass. So the bigger the relative parallax, or the smaller the distance, or the smaller the mass, the bigger this microlensing parallax, and then the more chance to see it. Now, unfortunately, it's also very biased toward long timescale. And the reason for this is that, as I told you, you're looking for something that's based on Earth motion, which has a characteristic timescale of a year. So if it's 20-day events, you're not seeing much acceleration. And so in it actually goes as a fourth power of the time, and that's what's actually driving you to the long timescales. And if you look at this paper summarizing some planetary events, the ones that say m equals theta e over kappa pi e are the ones where there was a parallax measurement. And you notice that there's, for these events, they're all very long, 101 days, 121 days, 70 days, 127 days. There's one exception, which is 7 days, and that's going to be the exception that proves the rule. So these 100-day timescale events are extremely rare, and that's why these microlensing parallaxes are rare. So many of these events with these parallaxes are extremely interesting. That's not the subject of my talk today, but this is a Jupiter-Saturn analog system, the first and so far only one that's ever been discovered by any method. And its mass and distance were measured by this parallax because it happened to be a very long event. And this is another extremely interesting, very, very interesting case. This is a binary star with an Earth mass planet orbiting one of the two stars. And the binary star is very late M dwarf with 0.2 solar mass components. It's a very interesting event because it has this tiny little dip here, which is how we figured out there was a planet. We got excited about this thing. We didn't know there was a binary, but we started to monitor it much more intensively. Actually, an amateur observer poking this telescope through holes in the clouds noticed that, between two holes in the clouds, it had jumped by a magnitude. It got in contact with us. We got intensive data over this thing, which is this. Then, any microlenser will tell you this is obviously binary. It has nothing to do with planets. But the very striking thing about this is Chung-Ho Han, who modeled this thing, so it's the three-body modeling is fairly complicated. But at a certain point, he just took out all of the information about this planet. And then he refit the model, and he found that the chi-square was 200 better when you put in the planet than when you didn't. That's the first thing. So you could detect the planet from this distortion of this binary thing by the planet, which seems very weird because the planet's Earth mass and this binary is like 10,000 times heavier. So it's, but also then he just fit for the planet without this data here, and he found he recovered the exact position and mass of the planet. So it means you could discover these very intriguing systems, binary stars, with even if the planet had been missed, which it normally would be because the caustic of it is so tiny. So it's just that we just happen to see this dip from the planet here, but if the trajectory had been like this, we wouldn't have seen it. And so this particular event also is a very long event. It has this parallax, and that's how we know the mass and distance of the system. So I'm not saying we never get this, but it's actually rare to get it. So another thing that could be done is to use terrestrial parallax. So, the basic scale of microlensing is of order AU. That's the size of the Yangtze ring. If that wasn't true, we wouldn't be able to detect planets at order AU from their stars. But it also means that the basic scale of parallax observation should be an AU. That Einstein, so things are going to look different if you're like one Einstein radius apart. But if you're 1/23,000th of an Einstein radius apart, which is what would happen if you're on two different points of the Earth, you don't expect there to be much difference. And so this is, an example of something that proves that that's not totally true. This is an event, the one that I told you was the exception that proves the rule, that actually looks different. So the amateur observer in South Africa sees an event which is rising a minute earlier than observers in Chile or in Canaries. So why is this observable? Okay, so you have this event lasts 7 days, that's particularly short, but so 7 days is very, very long compared to 1 minute. So on 1 minute timescales, you're not expecting the thing to look much different. But this is a super high magnification event. So the peak, even though the basic timescale event, 7 days, the peak of the event's only lasting 8 minutes. And so there, 1 minute is enough. Okay, so this is a weight, and this, it was, the mass of this was measured. It was not a planetary event, but anyway, this thing turns out to be a thick disk brown dwarf. And so this is just showing the geometry of that. So the next year, my student Jennifer Yee analyzed another one of these things. Well, because it's going 100 kilometers per second, so it's moving like thick disk star. So it's an old brown dwarf. Okay, so this is another event which has this terrestrial parallax measurement. And so after Jennifer and I had, you know, separately analyzed these terrestrial parallax measurements, we got more excited about it, and we thought maybe a lot of these terrestrial parallax measurements are being missed, and if we could understand theoretically how often they happen, then we could, you know, maybe figure out ways to find more of them. Maybe we're vastly underestimating the number. So here was our table of all the terrestrial parallax measurements and some of our equations, which I won't go through in detail. And we calculated at the end that, yes, indeed, we're wildly off. This number 2 that we've detected is wildly different than the number expected. The number expected is 0.1. So anyway, we've somehow been fabulously lucky, but this is not a way to solve this problem. So terrestrial parallax is interesting in a few cases, but it's not going to give you mass production of lenses. So now we're coming, terrestrial parallax would be very interesting for these Earth mass, free-floating planets. So perhaps you've seen this result, which is by, you know, 4 or 5 years old by now. So this is showing the distribution of timescales of the planets detected by the MOA collaboration in a 2-year period. And it shows a smooth distribution with a little bump here. Okay, so this bump cannot be produced by anything except free-floating planets or bad data. Okay, it could be that these things are not actually microlensing events or something, but anyway, if these are microlensing events, then they have to be due to free-floating planets or something that's mimicking a free-floating planet. Now, as it happens, the two shortest events here, one of them is guaranteed to be microlensing, which is, you bet your house on. Okay, the other one, I would say, is 99%. You know, microlensing. So in the very place that you're expecting very few events due to stars just happening to pass by their Einstein ring very quickly, very short events, much less in a day, then you're expecting like 10 to the minus 2 and you're actually finding 2. So this is a pretty good evidence for these free-floating planets, and it'd be really great if we could actually confirm this or measure their mass function or something. This is just their estimate. You know, they're probably Jupiter mass objects, and if they really have this frequency, there's 2 planets for every star. Not 2 planets for every G star, but 2 planets for every garden variety M star in the galaxy. So this is some vast planet population that's not understood, doesn't come out of any theory, nothing, okay? So it needs to be confirmed, because right now you just have this bump. Now one thing you could do is argue that maybe the mathematics of that bump is screwed up. And I won't go through this slide to prove it, but anyway, what this slide proves is that you cannot generate this bump by any sort of, you know, thing in the distribution other than a discontinuity in the mass. That's the only thing that will produce that bump. So, what? 2 Jupiter mass planets, the bound planets? It might be of order, 1 or 2. It seems to be more, but it's hard to tell because we don't know how many bound planets there are. But it's of the same order. The problem is kicking them out. You have Jupiter mass planets that have to be kicked out by something that's bigger than that. So then they should be leaving behind, typically, some huge planet that's still there that we don't see, or maybe it's binary stars or just disrupting whole systems. Anyway, I don't want to get into speculation about this. All I want to say is it's an outstanding problem in this field that can be solved by can be investigated by parallaxes, and probably not by just looking at these bumps more closely, bumps in the distribution. Okay, so satellite parallaxes is going to be the panacea. So satellite parallaxes were first thought of by Refstail in 1966. He told me he almost was not given a thesis by his committee because they considered that he wasn't actually doing physics, just speculating about things that would never happen. Anyway, this diagram, pretty much totally incomprehensible. So 30 years later, I didn't know about Rustell's work, and I worked this out independently. And he sent me a very polite letter explaining that he'd already done this work. But one thing that came about from doing it independently is that I have better diagrams. And so what you have happen is that, as you know, here, if you look in this diagram here, the as in the other diagrams, the source goes by the lens, and then it creates a light curve with, you know, it has certain impact parameters of a certain peak height. And then, as seen by the satellite, it's going through the Einstein ring in a different place. So it's different time of maximum and a different peak height. And you could reconstruct these two tracks from these curves. The problem is that you don't actually know which side of the lens the source passed on. So this diagram is just as good a reconstruction from this as this diagram is and these other two diagrams. Okay, so the difference between this diagram doesn't matter much because you get the same amplitude of parallax, just different direction, which is usually not that interesting. But in this case, you have a deep degeneracy. And so this was considered to be a major problem for many years, but actually we'll see that it's solved. I put in a proposal in 1996 to make a parallax satellite for microlensing, and it was turned down in favor of some other, I don't know, WMAP or something, some other useless satellite. And so then when Spitzer was launched, it used to be called CERTIF, one of the guys, Mike Warner, who's a big backer of this, asked me, you know, he said this would be good for microlensing. I sort of doubted it, you know, but anyway, he pressed on me, and I wrote up this paper about it. And you know, at this time, it used to take longer to get the paper back from the editor, so it was like 6 months before I got it back. And when I got it back, I couldn't understand hardly any of the equations in these, but I just assumed, I thought the author was reliable, and so I just let it go through. And so we actually did observations. Subo Dong did led this work for one particular event that was found in 2005 towards the SMC. And then after that, Spitzer invited me, and they went to Warren Mission. They invited me to a special conference they were having for new ideas for what to do in Warren Mission, and they specifically invited this parallax idea. I made a presentation, and they told me they couldn't help me, that they couldn't do target opportunity observation, and just forget it. I totally forgot about this and wrote them off for a long time. And then following some other incidents having to do with Kepler, I was kind of jostled a little bit by Chas Weichmann to maybe put in a Spitzer proposal. And so this is my proposal. I propose to give, okay, Spitzer can only look at these microlensing events for 38 days a year. So I propose to get all 38 days, or really 40 days, and just totally turn it over to microlensing. So I put in sort of 960 hours of microlensing. And I, you know, this is a proposal where I said, yeah, I can do this. Okay, so of course this is an innovative idea, so the TAC immediately rejected it. I was ranked second quartile. But the director was smarter than the TAC, and he gave me not 900 hours, but 100 hours to do a pilot project to demonstrate that this was feasible. And so, you know, this is another, you know, one of these is a bulge lens, one's a disc lens, they have different parallaxes, just showing you can cover it. Okay, so here's what actually came out of that thing. It's pretty amazing, isn't it? This is what we said would happen, and this is what did happen. So we're actually measuring these parallaxes, we did this reconstruction, but it turns, and I told you about this degeneracy, but in this case, and it turns out in many other cases, I'll show you, this degeneracy can be broken by a variety of different effects. So in this case, we did it by proper motion of the source, but anyway, we are able to break this degeneracy in the overwhelming majority of cases and recover parallaxes. So not only that, but in one of the cases of the events we're looking at, we found a planet. Okay, so planets are found in a minority of microlensing events, so a minority of our sample. But anyway, you see the same thing. It's actually very striking. Here's the planet. So the planet was found in Ogle data. I just happened to be looking at the Ogle data, deciding which events to monitor with Spitzer, and I noticed it was rising, and so then it went through this dip. We didn't have analysis of the Spitzer data at that time because our pipelines weren't working. So at the end, months later, we got the Spitzer data. You see this kind of a duplicate of the ground-based light curve happening 20 days before. So this is like, not, you know, it's just poster child for this effect. And that it is incredibly challenging to organize these observations because Spitzer will not respond to you. You just call up and say, Spitzer, please look at something. It doesn't work that way. They wouldn't even accept, in general, target of opportunity of any kind. So what we did was we had, you know, every day we had 2.6 hours of dummy observations that were just pointing at some place that we didn't know what it was. And once a week, we would send up to Spitzer, change your dummy observations to this set of observations this week. So they could set the whole pipeline up and just have this one little tweak to it. And so this is just showing that scheduling that we worked with. So we had to completely change the way Spitzer worked to do this. This one, interesting. But this is the caustic geometry showing that these things are caused by going by, you know, cusp approaches. This is not so important because the main thing is just that we detected a planet. Okay, so now we're going to get to a pretty important question, which is galactic distribution. Oops. I think it's Saturn mass. There's an important question of galactic distribution of planets. We'd like to find the masses or distances of our individual microlensing planets, but there's a specific scientific question we'd like to address. Do planets form differently in the solar neighborhood than in other parts of the galaxy, in particular the central part of our galaxy? Because the star formation in the center of our galaxy was very different than it was over here. There was a huge burst of formation, star formation. There was some very intense radiation field. Some people believe that the disks around stars that give rise to planets could not survive, or at least could not generate planets under those conditions. And so, you know, this is another lever that we have on how to figure out where you know, how planets form and how they evolve. So how are we going to do this? Well, in this case, if we can find the distances to each one of these planets, and then we can take the cumulative distribution of those distances, that's what's shown here, and then we can compare it to the cumulative distribution of the planets, this is a cumulative distribution of events, this is a cumulative distribution of the planets. If the planets are more concentrated towards, you know, the nearby than the events are, then that shows that they form more easily in the disk than they do in the bulge. Okay, so you can't do that in this case because you only have one detection in this sample, but I mean, the point was to prove the concept. Now, there's one thing that's kind of a lie about this diagram, is what I've shown here is the distribution of distances to these planets. But actually, in order to figure out what the relative distribution of planets is to underlying population, you don't want to ask what's the distribution of the events, but what's the distribution of the planet sensitivities? So we didn't calculate the planet sensitivities here because there's no point because we don't have any basis for making a measurement. But that's what you have to do in the future. And that means that you have to maximize the planet sensitivity of each one of these microlensing events that you're following by getting a lot of follow-up observations on them. So that's a separate subject because that actually, it's not trivial to get the follow-up observations, but it's also not trivial to have to design an experiment so that the sensitivity is the same to events whether or not they have planets. So unless you're doing that, then this is not a fair comparison. So that's a matter of work in progress, but anyway, we have the wherewithal to do that. So based on this diagram and the other things that I showed you, okay, we got back our data, you know, downloaded by the beginning of August. We had three papers out by the time of the Spitzer deadline of October 29th showing with 24 events analyzed showing that we could in fact do this. And this time the TAC came back and they gave us 832 hours of time to carry out this experiment in 2015. And just to mention that there's other interesting science here with binaries, but I probably don't have time to tell you about it. Okay, how this Spitzer thing got started was from Kepler. So probably you guys heard that Kepler broke and lost its one of its reaction wheels. As soon as that happened, Keith Horn and I wrote a paper saying that Kepler could be used to do microlensing parallaxes. Now I've written several hundred papers, of which I would say 100 of them are ideas that are going directly from my typewriter into the wastebasket, you know, as far as nobody ever paying attention to them. And so that I strongly suspected that would happen here as well. But our idea was, previously all microlensing parallax ideas had been, you find an event and you tell the telescope in space to look at the same event, and then you get a parallax. Okay, this is a non-starter for Kepler, because Kepler will not listen to you. They're just going to look someplace and stay looking there, you know, for 80 days. So you can't tell them anything. So, but nobody had ever had a camera when we were thinking about parallax in the first place, like Kepler, which is capable of monitoring tens of square degrees, and simultaneously. They'd always had narrow angle cameras, that's why you're always pointing at one thing. So our idea was to multiplex by looking at many events simultaneously without even knowing where they were for mass production of microlens parallaxes. And this is from our paper saying that this should be done. This is what you would like to do. You would like to turn Kepler onto the densest microlensing fields where all the events are taking place and put it right in the middle here and just download everything. There's many constraints on this. First of all, Kepler can't download all its pixels. It can only download about 5 square degrees of pixels. But anyway, it could use 5 square degrees. But you also can't do this because Kepler is busted. And so it's only has 2 reaction wheels. It has to be aligned with its own orbit. And that restricts you to here. But it still turns out that there's this rich area of microlensing that you can do. And when you look at it more closely, this is what you get. So I was at some meeting, and I was promoting this idea as I don't know, like I'm always doing, and a guy gets up, I didn't think there anything's going to be done about it, but a guy gets up from the back and says, well, I'm working with the Kepler K2 project, I think this is a great idea, let's talk about how we can make it happen. And so it really looks like NASA's going to do this thing now, and we're going to get this other aspect. And this is really great for free-floating planets. I showed you these distribution of short timescale events. Now, if you have a short timescale event that's due to a star, okay, the reason this can happen is that the star and the source star are very close together, so you get a small Einstein ring, so you can cross it very quickly. But then the projected Einstein ring is huge, and it means that the parallax is very small, and therefore the Earth and the satellite will see the same event. It's also true if this is some weird type of cataclysmic variable or some other astrophysical phenomena that's not related to microlensing, you'll also see the same thing like this. But if it's a free-floating planet, you'll see something like this. There'll be no doubt. You'll see an event that's offset in time and impact parameter. And you'll be able to verify and also start to get a handle on the mass function of these free-floating planets. So this is the main selling point of this, although it's also going to contribute to the galactic distribution of planets. Okay, so there's some challenges in this. This is what the Kepler field is going to look like. It's just going to, you know, in a real image with a ground-based telescope, it looks great. It's just a huge mess with Kepler because the large pixels, etc. But we believe we can analyze this, and we're working on it now. Okay, I want to switch gears slightly and just show you this model of a Korean microlensing telescope. So, like 10 years ago, there was people began moving to making bigger cameras. So I told you about survey plus follow-up. So in the follow-up observations, somebody finds the events in the survey, and then the follow-up people look at them intensively, because the surveys are only looking at these things maybe once every day or something like that. You can't find planets that way. But for if you could make a bigger camera, then you could start observing, you know, just kind of go like this. You keep coming back to the same field every 10 minutes. You wouldn't need any follow-up. So people have begun building bigger telescopes like this, and we're talking about it in 2005. We held a conference, and Chung Ho Han was my first student who came to this conference, and he said, okay, now we have going to have telescopes in Chile and in New Zealand, which are doing this, and I'm going to go to the Korean government and ask them for $10 million to build a telescope in Africa and complete this network. And so he did that 1 year, and he got rejected. He did it the next year. He also got rejected. And then the third year, he realized he was doing something wrong. He went back to the government and said, give me $30 million. I'll build 3 telescopes, one on each continent. We won't have to deal with these other people to make planets. We'll put Korea in control of this business. So anyway, this is a mock-up of what this is supposed to look like. And then here's the construction. What? South America, Australia, and South Africa. You're looking at the southern sky, so you have to go in the south. Anyway, this is constructed, and now 2 of these 3 telescopes are working, and the third one's going to be operating in Australia in a few months, and then we'll get continuous coverage. And so the number of microlensing planets right now is probably a total of 60 or something like that if we include the unpublished ones. But it's probably fine, like 25 to 40 planets per year. So So W1st is supposed to complete the census of planets. I mean, it's an idea that goes back 10 years, and I personally played a role in by writing a white paper for the U.S. Decadal Report, which called the whole astronomical community lemmings and seemed to catch their attention. So they made this a top priority. And so it's going to discover a lot of planets, but anyway, that's not what I want to talk about right now. There's a huge amount of non-microlensing science that's going to come out of the microlensing field. So the idea behind these surveys is that you're going to get 40,000 epochs over 3 square degrees in 6 continuous 72-day campaigns with 100 images per day and high signal-to-noise ratio. And so one of the things you can be able to do is discover a huge number of Kuiper Belt objects. So right now, out here, there's like 3 Kuiper Belt objects known, and their orbits are known to 20%. So with W1st microlensing survey, you can find Kuiper Belt objects at the break here. You can measure their periods. The vertical axis log of number, so this is 1,000. Oh, this is H-band magnitude of the Kuiper Belt object. So this is the point at which Kuiper Belt objects are thought to peter out right here. You get 0.1% measurement of their periods. So these Kuiper Belt objects are an incredible probe of the early solar system if you can make these measurements. You're thinking, okay, you're looking in the galactic bulge, the most crowded fields in the sky, and you're supposed to find a Kuiper Belt object in here. Well, it seems very hard, you know, they're going to be tracing through, and that's what the referee had told me. But here's an actual search by the Ogle group, not exactly in the bulge, but in the nearby disk. And, you know, how did they find a Kuiper Belt object here? Well, they did it by taking difference imaging, okay? They just took 2 images and then subtracted from one another. This is a standard microlensing technique. You have an excess here and a deficit here because this Kuiper Belt object moved. So this is like winking plates, right? So this is how the original Kuiper Belt object was found in 1931. And in fact, this is not a new discovery, but a rediscovery of that same one that was found in 1931, aka Pluto. So you could also find binaries for this. I don't want to go into detail about this. Okay, 0.1% periods at the break. So you really get detailed knowledge of this. So another thing that you can do is do astroseismology. So, and do incredible parallaxes. So the precision of this, you know, potentially is incredible. I still have to fight with the people on the W1st team to get them to organize their observations correctly. And I don't know whether I'll win or lose that fight. But anyway, if I win it, then the individual measurement error at this, you know, for bright objects would typically be like, you know, 60 microarcseconds. This is already pretty good, but this is individual measurement. There's going to be 40,000 measurements like that. So it means the parallaxes are going to be like 300 nanoarcseconds. Okay, this is like, 50 times better than Gaia. Okay, I think it's for a handful of stars, but actually I'll show you the numbers later. And the photometry will be millimag photometry, and this is what enables you to do astroseismology. So there'll be parallaxes at 10 microarcsecond level, which is the good Gaia level for 100 million stars. Okay, so this is a very rich resource for structure, for analysis of the galaxy, for finding black holes and wide binaries, just an incredible number of different things. This is the window function of a Fourier transform of the observations for Kepler and for W1st. Okay, Kepler, W1st looks terrible, but look at the scale. This is 0.2 microhertz. Okay, this is well below the level of anything that you're interested in when you're trying to resolve spectra of astroseismic targets. So you're not going to be able to do as well as Kepler, but anyway, you're looking at way, way more stars. So a million stars you'll be able to do and measure both these measurements. And most of these stars will be in the bulge, but 10% will be in the disk. So it would be a huge resource for galactic structure all the way along the line of sight. Okay, so what I've tried to do is tell you, where microlensing is going, but, you know, it's going into space in terms of parallaxes and future W1st, and that there's a huge amount of information that you can gain from microlensing surveys that have nothing to do with microlensing itself. And so then I'll just take questions.
So, who wants to start off the questions?
So as of now, do we know anything about the galactic distribution of these free-floating planets?
So we know absolutely nothing about them. We have, basically we have two parameters that are just describing them in the crudest possible fashion. I should say that the MOA group has four times as much data in the can as they had, as they published, and the OVA group probably has 10 times more data than that. And these guys really need to get to analyzing it. I think more can be learned from that, but so far, no.
So if WFIRST winds up having a 10-year mission, is there a follow-up survey? A secondary microlensing survey, maybe pointing in a different direction.
You could continue the same microlensing survey. It wouldn't really make much difference whether you change fields from microlensing, but I think it would be useful because you'd just find new events. But I think it'd be useful to change fields from the standpoint of the other science that comes out of it. So yeah, you could find more planets, but I think the 5 years of WFIRST will probably tell us, you're into root N when you're going from 5 years to 10 years, so I'd be most excited about the first 5 years.
Have there been cases, or is there any hope of detecting, I guess with microlensing or with anything else, of a planet and one of its moons?
Yes, there's hope. Kepler has some sensitivity to moons, but I think that no reliable moons have been detected. So the Earth's moon, could be not the actual Earth's moon, but Earth's moon 4 kiloparsecs from us could be detected because the Earth's moon is separated enough from the Earth that the Earth's Einstein radius is sort of comparable to the distance to the moon, and that means that we can give rise to these effects. And Dave Bennett, in his simulations of an early, concept of WFIRST, showed that these things would give rise to definable bumps. But, it's low probability, but not zero.
Thanks. So I guess I was just wondering, when you talk about microlensing events, you're thinking about isolated events, but could one think of a different mode of detecting microlensing, which is basically a lot of very weak microlensing events, and one can detect that as some sort of noise?
A different mode what?
A different mode of detecting microlensing as a lot of weak, very weak, basically, events. If you're not inside the Einstein radius, but you're basically far away from...
Yeah, so the problem with that from the standpoint of photometric microlensing is that the magnification drops off as the fourth power of the separation once you get outside the Einstein ring. So you're 1 Einstein radius, you have a okay signal, 2 Einstein radius, maybe you detect something. At 4, it's well under 1%. So that's the main problem. But for astrometric microlensing, the effect falls off as linearly, or anyway, inversely, with distance. And so those effects can be detected much further away. The main problem is that the effects themselves are quite small, and so, doing astrometry at that level is just super challenging. And you have to consider that there's a huge number of noise sources, so these things are happening like 1 in a million times, so 1 in a million stars you're looking at, that's why Einstein gave up. Mm-hmm. But so if you have something that's happening 1 in a million times and you have some signal that looks like this, you're very convinced. But if you have like some noise and you have other sources of noise, it's pretty hard to...
So, I mean, we know stars are, I guess, correlated with each other. So, I mean, a lot of them are binaries or in clusters. And so couldn't you use, wouldn't that enhance the amount of noise? So I'm just thinking of whether you could use the correlation function of a stars, basically, by...
Well, that's what you're seeing in the binary. So we do see these binary microlensing events. These are, I didn't focus on it, but these are 6% of events. Even though half of stars are in binaries, then only 6% are giving rise to noticeable effects because the two stars have to be separated by a border of the Einstein radius or where they're just right. It's a combined star, two separate.
But I guess I'm thinking, so you're thinking about detecting them in individual events, but could you do it a statistic, like the same measure you, where you measure like two-point correlation function of galaxies, you okay. stack a lot of
so
things.
Yeah, so there's another context in which this takes place, which is in quasar microlensing. So because the optical depth in galactic microlensing is 10 to the minus 6, so anytime you take the square of this, you're winding up with basically zero. But in quasar microlensing, you know, the optical depth is by definition of order 1, because otherwise you wouldn't have strong lensing. And so then if, you know, even 20% of the mass is due to stars, then you have like overlapping caustics. And so there are these programs to study this statistically, which are now quite sophisticated, from correlations. We're actually just doing sort of random, you know, huge number of random realizations and seeing which ones can match the pattern, from which they derive statistical information about each system. And so I think that that has a pretty bright future. In fact, would benefit a lot from parallax observations. But it's, you know, it's mathematically related to this, but it's not physically related.
Any more questions? Okay, then let's thank the speaker again.